Lesson 3. Self-confidence. You can do it if you believe you can. Before approaching the fundamental principles upon which this lesson is founded, it will be of benefit to you to keep in mind the fact that it is practical, that it brings you the discoveries of more than 25 years of research, that it has the approval of the leading scientific men and women of the world who have tested every principle involved. Skepticism is the deadly enemy of progress and self-development. You might as well lay this program aside and stop right here as to approach this lesson with the feeling that it was written by some theorist who had never tested the principles upon which the lesson is based. Surely this is no age for the skeptic, because it is an age in which we have seen more of nature's laws uncovered and harnessed than had been discovered in all past history of the human race. Within 3 decades, we have witnessed the mastery of the air. We have explored the ocean. We have all but annihilated distances on the earth. We have harnessed the lightning and made it turn the wheels of industry. We have made 7 blades of grass grow where but one grew before. We have instantaneous communication between the nations of the world. Truly, this is an age of illumination and unfoldment. But we have as yet barely scratched the surface of knowledge. However, when we shall have unlocked the gate that leads to the secret power which is stored up within us, it will bring us knowledge that will make all past discoveries pale into oblivion by comparison. Thought is the most highly organized form of energy known to man, and this is an age of experimentation and research that is sure to bring us into greater understanding of that mysterious force called thought which reposes within us. We have already found out enough about the human mind to know that one may throw off the accumulated effects of 1,000 generations of fear through the aid of the principle of autosuggestion. We have already discovered the fact that fear is the chief reason for poverty and failure and misery that takes on 1,000 different forms. We have already discovered the fact that the person who masters fear may march on to successful achievement in practically any undertaking, despite all efforts to defeat him. The development of self-confidence starts with the elimination of this demon called fear, which sits upon a man's shoulder and whispers into his ear, "You can't do it. You are afraid to try. You are afraid of public opinion. You are afraid that you will fail. You are afraid that you have not the ability." This fear demon is getting into close quarters. Science has found a deadly weapon with which to put it to flight, and this lesson on self-confidence has brought you this weapon for use in your battle with the world-old enemy of progress, fear.
Herbert Spencer wrote, "Amidst all the mysteries by which we are surrounded, nothing is more certain than that we are in the presence of an infinite and eternal energy from which all things proceed."
The 6 basic fears of mankind. Every person falls heir to the influence of 6 basic fears. Under these 6 fears may be listed the lesser fears. The 6 basic or major fears are here enumerated, and the sources from which they are believed to have grown are described. The 6 basic fears are the fear of poverty, the fear of old age, the fear of criticism, the fear of loss of love of someone, the fear of ill health, the fear of death. Study the list. Then take inventory of your own fears and ascertain under which of the 6 headings you can classify them. Every human being who has reached the age of understanding is bound down to some extent by one or more of these 6 basic fears. As the first step in the elimination of these 6 evils, let us examine the sources from whence we inherited them.
Remember that when you make an appointment with another person, you assume the responsibility of punctuality, and that you have not the right to be a single minute late.
Physical and social heredity. All that man is, both physically and mentally, he came by through 2 forms of heredity. One is known as physical heredity, and the other is called social heredity. Through the law of physical heredity, man has slowly evolved from the amoeba, a single-cell animal form, through stages of development corresponding to all the known animal forms now on this earth, including those which are known to have existed, but which are now extinct. Every generation through which man has passed has added to his nature something of the traits, habits, and physical appearance of that generation. Our physical inheritance, therefore, is a heterogeneous collection of many habits and physical forms. There seems little, if any, doubt that while the six basic human fears could not have been inherited through physical heredity, these six basic fears being mental states of mind and therefore not capable of transmission through physical heredity, it is obvious that through physical heredity a most favorable lodging place for these six fears has been provided. By far the most important part of a person's makeup comes to him through the law of social heredity. This term having reference to the methods by which one generation imposes upon the minds of the generation under its immediate control the superstitions, beliefs, legends, and ideas which it, in turn, inherited from the generation preceding. The term social heredity should be understood to mean any and all sources through which a person acquires knowledge, such as schooling of religious and all other natures, reading, word-of-mouth conversation, storytelling, and all manner of thought inspiration coming from personal experiences. Through the operation of the law of social heredity, anyone having control of the mind of a child may, through intense teaching, plant in that child's mind any idea, whether false or true, in such a manner that the child accepts it as true and it becomes as much a part of the child's personality as any cell or organ of its physical body, and just as hard to change in its nature. It is through the law of social heredity that the religionist plants in the child mind dogmas and creeds and religious ceremonies too numerous to describe, holding those ideas before that mind until the mind accepts them and forever seals them as part of its irrevocable belief. The mind of a child which has not come into the age of general understanding during an average period covering, let us say, the first 2 years of its life, is plastic, open, clean, and free. Any idea planted in such a mind by one in whom the child has confidence takes root and grows, so to speak, in such a manner that it never can be eradicated or wiped out, no matter how opposed to logic or reason that idea may be. Many religionists claim that they can so deeply implant the tenets of their religion in the mind of a child that there never can be room in that mind for any other religion, either in whole or in part. The claims are not greatly overdrawn. With this explanation of the manner in which the law of social heredity operates, you will be ready to examine the sources from which humans inherit the six basic fears. Moreover, any listener, except those who have not yet grown big enough to examine truth that steps upon the pet corns of their own superstitions, may check the soundness of the principle of social heredity as it is here applied to the six basic fears without going outside of his or her own personal experiences. Fortunately, practically the entire mass of evidence submitted in this lesson is of such a nature that all who sincerely seek the truth may ascertain for themselves whether the evidence is sound or not. For the moment, at least, lay aside your prejudices and preconceived ideas. You may always go back and pick them up again, you know. While we study the origin and nature of man's six worst enemies, the six basic fears.
Hill continued to re-examine the six fears throughout his life. His discussion of them appears in several variations. It appears first in the original version of The Law of Success, published in pamphlet form. There, in the Chapter 1 appendix, he lists the fears in a different order. Fear of ill health comes third, and fear of criticism fifth. Here, their positions are reversed. In Think and Grow Rich, he lists poverty, criticism, and ill health as the primary fears, saying that they are at the bottom of one's worries. Here, one sees the reason for his fascination with the subject. Indecision is the seedling of fear, he says. Indecision crystallizes into doubt, and the two become fear. Fear, then, becomes a symptom of the thought and action Hill shows us how to reform. His commentaries differ also. The most significant departures will be noted in context.
The fear of poverty. It requires courage to tell the truth about the origins of this fear, and still greater courage, perhaps, to accept the truth after it has been told. The fear of poverty grew out of man's inherited tendency to prey upon his fellow man economically. Nearly all forms of lower animals have instinct, but appear not to have the power to reason and think. Therefore, they prey upon one another physically. We, with our superior sense of intuition, thought, and reason, do not eat our fellow human beings bodily. We get more satisfaction out of eating others financially. Of all the ages of the world of which we know anything, the age in which we live seems to be the age of money worship. A person is considered less than the dust of the earth unless he can display a fat bank account. Nothing brings us so much suffering and humiliation as does poverty. No wonder we fear poverty. Through a long line of inherited experiences with others like us, we have learned for certain that this animal cannot always be trusted where matters of money and other evidences of earthly possessions are concerned. Many marriages have their beginning and oftentimes their ending solely on the basis of the wealth possessed by one or both of the contracting parties. It is no wonder that the divorce courts are busy. Society could quite properly be spelled society with a dollar sign replacing the S, because it is inseparably associated with the dollar mark. So eager are we to possess wealth that we will acquire it in whatever manner we can, through legal methods if possible, through other methods if necessary. The fear of poverty is a terrible thing. A man may commit murder, engage in robbery, rape, and all other manner of violation of the rights of others, and still regain a high station in the minds of people of his society, providing always that he does not lose his wealth. Poverty, therefore, is a crime, an unforgivable sin, as it were. No wonder we fear it. Every statute book in the world bears evidence that the fear of poverty is one of the six basic fears of humankind, for in every such book of laws may be found various and sundry laws intended to protect the weak from the strong. To spend time trying to prove either that the fear of poverty is one of man's inherited fears, or that his fear has its origin in man's nature to cheat his fellow man would be similar to trying to prove that 3 times 2 are 6. Obviously, no one would ever fear poverty if we had any grounds for trusting our fellow men. For there is food and shelter and raiment and luxury of every nature sufficient for the needs of every person on earth. And all these blessings would be enjoyed by every person except for the swinish habit that humans have of trying to push all the other swine out of the trough, even after everyone has all and more than needed.
In the Chapter 1 appendix to Think and Grow Rich, Hill wrote, "Humans are such great offenders in this respect that nearly every state and nation has been obliged to pass laws, scores of laws, to protect the weak from the strong. Every code of laws ever written provides indisputable evidence of humanity's nature to prey upon its weaker members economically." Unquote. In Think and Grow Rich, Hill lists 6 symptoms of the fear of poverty. 1. Indifference, lack of ambition, laziness, etc. 2. Indecision. 3. Doubt, expressed through alibis and excuses. 4. Worrying, expressed through fault-finding. 5. Overcaution, shown in general negativity. And 6. Procrastination.
The fear of old age. In the main, this fear grows out of 2 sources. First, the thought that old age may bring with it poverty. Secondly, human beings have learned to fear old age because it meant the approach of another and possibly a much more horrible world than this one, which is known to be bad enough. In the basic fear of old age, humans have 2 very sound reasons for their apprehension, the one growing out of distrust of those who may seize whatever worldly goods we may possess, and the other arising from the terrible pictures of the world to come, which were deeply planted in our minds through the law of social heredity long before any of us came into possession of that mind. Is it any wonder that so many fear the approach of old age?
In every soul there has been deposited the seed of a great future, but that seed will never germinate, much less grow to maturity, except through the rendering of useful service.
The fear of criticism. Just how humans acquired this basic fear, it would be hard, if not impossible, definitely to determine, but one thing is certain: we all have it in well-developed form. I am inclined to attribute the basic fear of criticism to that part of our inherited nature that prompts many of us not only to take away our fellow humans' goods and wares, but to justify our actions by criticism of the character of others. The fear of criticism takes on many different forms, the majority of which are petty and trivial in nature, even to the extent of being childish in the extreme. The makers of all manner of clothing have not been slow to capitalize on this basic fear of criticism with which all humankind is cursed. Every season it will be observed the styles in many articles of wearing apparel change. Who establishes the styles? Certainly not the purchaser of clothes, but the manufacturer of clothes. Why does he change the styles so often? Obviously, this change is made so that the manufacturer can sell more clothes. For the same reason, the manufacturers of automobiles, with a few rare and very sensible exceptions, change styles every season. The manufacturer of clothing knows how the human animal fears to wear a garment that is one season out of step with what they are all wearing now. Is this not true? Does not your own experience back it up? Powerful and mighty is the fear of criticism.
In Think and Grow Rich, we read, "The fear of criticism robs man of his initiative, destroys his power of imagination, limits his individuality, takes away his self-reliance, and does him damage in 100 other ways. Parents often do their children irreparable injury by criticizing them. It should be recognized as a crime. In reality, it is a crime of the worst nature for any parent to build an inferiority complex in the mind of a child through unnecessary criticism. Employers who understand human nature get the best there is in employees not by criticism, but by constructive suggestion."
The fear of loss of love of someone. The source from which this fear originated needs but little description, for it is obvious that it grew out of man's nature to steal his fellow man's mate, or at least to take liberties with her. There can be but little doubt that jealousy and all other similar forms of more or less mild dementia praecox, that is, insanity, grew out of the fear we all inherited of the loss of love of someone. Of all the sane fools I studied, the jealous lover is the oddest and strangest. Fortunately, I had personal experience of this form of insanity, but from that experience I learned that the fear of the loss of love of someone is one of the most painful, if not in fact the most painful, of all the six basic fears. And it seems reasonable to add that this fear plays more havoc with the human mind than do any of the other six basic fears of mankind, often leading to the more violent forms of permanent insanity.
Again, from Think and Grow Rich. "This fear fills the asylums with the insanely jealous, for jealousy is nothing but a form of insanity. It also fills the divorce courts and causes murders and other forms of cruel punishment. It is a holdover handed down through social heredity from the Stone Age, when man preyed upon his fellow man by stealing his mate by physical force. The method, but not the practice, has now changed to some extent. Instead of physical force, man now steals his fellow man's mate with pretty, colorful ribbons, and fast motor cars, and bootleg whiskey, and sparkling rocks, and stately mansions."
The fear of ill health. This fear has its origin, to considerable extent also, in the same sources from which the fears of poverty and old age are derived. The fear of ill health is closely associated with both poverty and old age because it also leads toward the borderline of terrible worlds which people know little of, but about which there are many discomforting stories. I strongly suspect that those engaged in the business of selling good health methods have had considerable to do with keeping the fear of ill health alive in the human mind. For longer than the record of the human race can be relied upon, the world has known of various and sundry forms of therapy and health purveyors. If a person gains a living from keeping others in good health, it seems natural that he or she would use every possible means to persuade them of the need for caregiving services. Thus, in time, it might be that people would inherit a fear of ill health.
From Think and Grow Rich. "This fear is born of both physical and social heredity. From birth until death, there is eternal warfare within every physical body, warfare between groups of cells. One group being known as the friendly builders of the body, and the other as the destroyers, or disease germs. The seed of fear is born in the physical body to begin with, as the result of nature's cruel plan of permitting the stronger forms of cell life to prey upon the weaker. Social heredity has played its part through lack of cleanliness and knowledge of sanitation, also through the law of suggestion, cleverly manipulated by those who profited by ill health." Unquote. In Think and Grow Rich, Hill also suggests that ill health comes from fear, writing, Thought impulses immediately begin to translate themselves into their physical equivalent, whether those thoughts are voluntary or involuntary. All thought has a tendency to clothe itself in its physical equivalent.
The fear of death. To many, this is the worst of all the six basic fears, and the reason why it is so regarded becomes obvious to even the casual student of psychology. The terrible pangs of fear associated with death may be charged directly to religious fanaticism, the source that is more responsible for it than are all other sources combined. So-called heathen are not as much afraid of death as are the civilized, especially that portion of the civilized population that has come under the influence of theology. For hundreds of millions of years, we have been asking the still unanswered, and it may be the unanswerable questions, whence and whither? Where did I come from and where am I going after death? The more cunning and crafty, as well as the honest but credulous of the race, have not been slow to offer the answer to these questions. In fact, the answering of these questions has become one of the so-called learned professions, despite the fact that but little learning is required to enter this profession. Witness now the major source of the origin of the fear of death. Come into my tent, embrace my faith, accept my dogmas and pay my salary, and I will give you a ticket that will admit you straightway into heaven when you die, says the leader of one form of sectarianism. Remain out of my tent, says this same leader, and you will go direct to hell, where you will burn throughout eternity. While in fact the self-appointed leader may not be able to provide safe conduct into heaven, nor by lack of such provision allow the unfortunate seeker after truth to descend into hell, the possibility of the latter seems so terrible that it lays hold of the mind and creates that fear of fears, the fear of death. In truth, no one knows and no one has ever known what heaven or hell is like, or if such places exist. And this very lack of definite knowledge opens the door of the human mind to the charlatan, to enter and control that mind with his stock of legerdemain and various brands of trickery, deceit, and fraud. The truth is this, nothing less and nothing more. No person knows, nor has any person ever known, where we come from at birth or where we go at death. Anyone claiming otherwise is either deceiving himself, or he is a conscious impostor who makes it a business to live without rendering service of value while preying upon the credulity of humanity. Be it said in their behalf, however, the majority of those engaged in selling tickets into heaven actually believe not only that they know where heaven exists, but that their creeds and formulas will give safe passage to all who embrace them. This belief may be summed up in one word, credulity. Religious leaders generally make the broad, sweeping claim that the present civilization owes its existence to the work done by the churches. I am willing to grant their claims to be correct if at the same time I am permitted to add that even if this claim be true, the theologians haven't done a great deal to brag about. But it is not, cannot be true that civilization has grown out of the efforts of the organized churches and creeds if by the term civilization is meant the uncovering of the natural laws and the many inventions to which the world is the present heir. If the theologians wish to claim that part of civilization that has to do with man's conduct toward his fellow man, they are perfectly welcome to it as far as I am concerned. But on the other hand, if they presume to gobble up the credit for all the scientific discovery of mankind, I would protest vigorously.
You can make and put into action a plan of attack on fear. Ask yourself which of the six basic fears is doing you the greatest damage. We are slowly discovering more about these six basic fears. The most effective tool with which to fight them is organized knowledge. Ignorance and fear are twins. They are generally found together. Were it not for ignorance, the six basic fears would disappear from human thought. In every public library, you can find the remedy for these six enemies. Begin with Ralph Waldo Emerson's Essay on Compensation. Then select some of the previously mentioned books on self-suggestion and inform yourself about the principle through which your beliefs of today become the realities of tomorrow. Through the principle of social heredity, the ignorance and superstition of the past have been passed on to you. But you are living in a modern age. On every hand, you may see evidence that every effect has a natural cause. Begin now to study effects by their causes, and soon you will emancipate your mind from the burden of the six basic fears. Begin by selecting two people whom you know close at hand. One should represent your idea of failure, and the other should correspond to your idea of success. Find out what made one a failure and the other a success. Get the real facts. In the process of gathering these facts, you will have taught yourself a great lesson on cause and effect. Nothing ever just happens. In a single month of properly directed self-suggestion, you may place your foot upon the neck of every one of your six basic fears. In 12 months of persistent effort, you may drive the entire herd into the corner, where it will never again do you any serious injury. You will resemble tomorrow the dominating thoughts that you keep alive in your mind today. Plant in your mind the seed of determination to whip your six basic fears, and the battle will have been half won then and there. Keep this intention in your mind, and it will slowly push your six worst enemies out of sight, as they exist nowhere except in your own mind. A person who is powerful fears nothing, not even God. The powerful person loves God, but fears him never. Enduring power never grows out of fear. Any power that is built upon fear is bound to crumble and disintegrate. Understand this great truth, and you will never be so unfortunate as to try to raise yourself to power through the fears of other people who may owe you temporary allegiance. You are fortunate if you have learned the difference between temporary defeat and failure. More fortunate still if you have learned the truth that the very seed of success is dormant in every defeat that you experience.
How lessons are learned. It is hardly sufficient to state that social heredity is the method through which humans gather all knowledge that reaches us through the five senses. It is more to the point to state how social heredity works in as many different applications as will give you a comprehensive understanding of that law. The law of social heredity. Let us begin with some of the lower forms of animal life and examine the manner in which they are affected by the law of social heredity. Shortly after I began to examine the major sources from which we gather the knowledge that makes us what we are, some 30-odd years ago, I discovered the nest of a ruffed grouse. The nest was so located that the mother bird could be seen from a considerable distance when she was on the nest. With the aid of a pair of field glasses, I watched the bird closely until the young birds were hatched out. It happened that the regular daily observation was made but a few hours after the young birds came out of the shell. Desiring to know what would happen, I approached the nest. The mother bird remained nearby until I was within 10 or 12 feet of her. Then she disarranged her feathers, stretched one wing over her leg, and went hobbling away, making a pretense of being crippled. Being somewhat familiar with the tricks of mother birds, I did not follow, but instead went to the nest to take a look at the little ones. Without the slightest signs of fear, they turned their eyes toward me, moving their heads first one way and then another. I reached down and picked one of them up. With no signs of fear, it stood in the palm of my hand. I laid the bird back in the nest and went away to a safe distance to give the mother bird a chance to return. The wait was short. Very soon she began cautiously to edge her way back toward the nest until she was within a few feet of it, when she spread her wings and ran as fast as she could, uttering meanwhile a series of sounds similar to those of a hen when she has found some morsel of food and wishes to call her brood to partake of it. She gathered the little birds around and continued to quiver in a highly excited manner, shaking her wings and ruffling her feathers. One could almost hear her words as she gave the little birds their first lesson in self-defense through the law of social heredity. "You silly little creatures, do you not know that humans are your enemies? Shame on you for allowing that man to pick you up in his hands. It's a wonder he didn't carry you off and eat you alive. The next time you see a man approaching, make yourselves scarce. Lie down on the ground, run under leaves, go anywhere to get out of sight and remain out of sight until the enemy is well on his way. The little birds stood around and listened to the lecture with intense interest. After the mother bird had quieted down, I again started to approach the nest. When within 20 feet or so of the guarded household, the mother bird again started to lead me in the other direction by crumpling up her wing and hobbling along as if she were crippled. I looked at the nest, but the glance was in vain. The little birds were nowhere to be found. They had learned rapidly to avoid their natural enemy, thanks to their natural instinct. Again I retreated, waited until the mother bird had reassembled her household, then came out to visit them, but with similar results. When I approached the spot where I last saw the mother bird, not the slightest signs of the little fellows were to be found.
Appropriately enough, Hill here turns to animal stories as a way of discussing the development of human character. Hill's frequent references to nature's Bible demonstrate that he believed human beings are a part of nature, but he also values the importance of the human social environment. In weighing in on the relative influences of nature and nurture, Hill uses the term physical heredity for what we today might call genetic predisposition. By social heredity, he means what we might call simply conditioning or socialization. Many authors and lecturers of Napoleon Hill's day prided themselves as storytellers, and they often drew upon the natural world for examples around which to spin a yarn that would entertain while conveying the points they were trying to make. However, the America in which most of us live today is not nearly as bucolic as the one in which Hill grew up. There's a lot less catching of frogs in the creek or watching of grouse in the fields, and kids think chickens come as a half dozen thighs or breasts shrink-wrapped in a package from the supermarket. For that reason, as this edition was being prepared, there was considerable discussion among the editors about the inclusion of Hill's animal analogies. It was concluded that the points made are as valid today as they were when Hill wrote them, and though they might be considered quaint by the modern listener, the stories themselves provide interesting insights into the life and times of Napoleon Hill.
When I was a small boy, I captured a young crow and made a pet of it. The bird became quite well satisfied with its domestic surroundings and learned to perform many tricks requiring considerable intelligence. After the bird was big enough to fly, it was permitted to go wherever it pleased. Sometimes it would be gone for many hours, but it always returned home before dark. One day, some wild crows became involved in a fight with an owl in a field near the house where the pet crow lived. As soon as the pet heard the caw, caw, caw of its wild relatives, it flew up on top of the house and with signs of great agitation walked from one end of the house to the other. Finally, it took wing and flew in the direction of the battle. I followed to see what would happen. In a few minutes, I found the pet sitting on the lower branches of a tree. Two wild crows were on a limb just above, chattering and walking back and forth, acting very much in the same fashion that angry parents behave toward their offspring when chastising them. As I approached, the two wild crows flew away, one of them circling around the tree a few times, meanwhile letting out a terrible flow of the most abusive language, which no doubt was directed at its foolish relative who hadn't enough sense to fly while the flying was good. The pet was called, but it paid no attention. That evening it returned home, but would not come near the house. It sat on a high limb of an apple tree and talked in crow language for about 10 minutes, saying, no doubt, that it had decided to go back to the wild life of its fellows. It then flew away and did not return until 2 days later, when it came back and did some more talking in crow language, keeping at a safe distance meanwhile. It then went away and never returned. Social heredity had robbed me of a fine pet. The only consolation I got from the loss of my crow was the thought that it had shown fine sportsmanship by coming back and giving notice of its intent to depart. Many farmhands have left the farm without going to the trouble of this formality. It is a well-known fact that a fox will prey upon all manner of fowl and small animals with the exception of the skunk. No reason need be stated as to why Mr. Skunk enjoys immunity. A fox may tackle a skunk once, but never twice. For this reason, a skunk hide, when nailed to a chicken roost, will keep all but the very young and inexperienced foxes at a safe distance. The odor of a skunk, once experienced, is never to be forgotten. No other smell even remotely resembles it. It is nowhere recorded that any mother fox ever taught her young how to detect and keep away from the familiar smell of a skunk, but all who are informed on fox lore know that foxes and skunks never seek lodging in the same cave. But one lesson is sufficient to teach the fox all it cares to know about skunks. Through the law of social heredity operating via the sense of smell, one lesson serves for an entire lifetime. A bullfrog can be caught on a fishhook by attaching a small piece of red cloth or any other small red object to the hook and dangling it in front of the frog's nose. That is, Mr. Frog may be caught in this manner provided he is hooked the first time he snaps at the bait. But if he is poorly hooked and makes a getaway, or if he feels the point of the hook when he bites at the bait but is not caught, he will never make the same mistake again. I spent many hours in stealthy attempt to hook a particularly desirable specimen which had snapped and missed before learning that but one lesson in social heredity is enough to teach even a humble croaker that bits of red flannel are things to be let alone.
Is it not strange that we fear most that which never happens? That we destroy our initiative by the fear of defeat, when, in reality, defeat is a most useful tonic and should be accepted as such?
Once I owned a very fine male Airedale dog that caused no end of annoyance by his habit of coming home with a young chicken in his mouth. Each time the chicken was taken away from the dog, Andy was soundly switched, but to no avail. He continued his liking for fowl. For the purpose of saving the dog, if possible, and as an experiment with social heredity, this dog was taken to the farm of a neighbor who had a hen and some newly hatched chickens. The hen was placed in the barn and the dog was turned in with her. As soon as everyone was out of sight, the dog slowly edged up toward the hen, sniffed the air in her direction a time or two to make sure she was the kind of meat for which he was looking, then made a dive toward her. Meanwhile, Mrs. Hen had been doing some surveying on her own account, for she met Mr. Dog more than halfway. Moreover, she met him with such a surprise of wings and claws as he had never before experienced. The first round was clearly the hen's, but a nice fat bird reckoned the dog was not to slip between his paws so easily. Therefore, he backed away a short distance, then charged again. This time, Mrs. Hen lit upon his back, drove her claws into his skin, and made effective use of her sharp bill. Mr. Dog retreated to his corner, looking for all the world as if he were listening for someone to ring the bell and call the fight off until he got his bearings, but Mrs. Hen craved no time for deliberation. She had her adversary on the run and showed that she knew the value of the offensive by keeping him on the run. One could almost understand her words as she flogged the poor Airedale from one corner to another, keeping up a series of rapid-fire sounds that for all the world resembled the remonstrations of an angry mother who had been called upon to defend her offspring from an attack by older boys. The Airedale was a poor soldier. After running around the barn from corner to corner for about 2 minutes, he spread himself on the ground as flat as he could and did his best to protect his eyes with his paws. Mrs. Hen seemed to be making a special attempt to peck out his eyes. The owner of the hen then stepped in and retrieved her, or, more accurately stating it, he retrieved the dog, which in no way appeared to meet with the dog's disapproval. The next day, a chicken was placed in the cellar where the dog slept. As soon as he saw the bird, he tucked his tail between his legs and ran for a corner. He never again attempted to catch a chicken. One lesson in social heredity via the sense of touch was sufficient to teach him that while chicken chasing may offer some enjoyment, it is also fraught with many hazards. All these illustrations, with the exception of the first, describe the process of gathering knowledge through direct experience. Observe the marked difference between the knowledge gathered by direct experience and that which is gathered through the training of the young by the old, as in the case of the ruffed grouse and her young. The most impressive lessons are those learned by the young from the old through highly colored or emotionalized methods of teaching. When the mother grouse spread her wings, stood her feathers on end, shook herself like a man suffering with the palsy, and chattered to her young in a highly excited manner, she planted the fear of humans in their hearts in a manner which they were never to forget. The term social heredity, as used in connection with this lesson, has particular reference to all methods through which a child is taught any idea, dogma, creed, religion, or system of ethical conduct by its parents or those who may have authority over it, before reaching the age at which it may reason and reflect upon such teaching in its own way, estimating the age of such reasoning power at, let us say, 7 to 12 years. Fear in middle age. There are myriad forms of fear, but none are more deadly than the fear of poverty and old age. We drive our bodies as if they were slaves because we are so afraid of poverty that we wish to hoard money for what? Old age. This common form of fear drives us so hard that we overwork our bodies and bring on the very thing we are struggling to avoid. What a tragedy to watch men and women drive themselves when they begin to arrive along about the 40-year milepost of life, the age at which they are just beginning to mature mentally. At 40, we are just entering the age in which we are able to see and understand and assimilate the handwriting of nature as it appears in the forests and flowing brooks and faces of other adults and little children. Yet this devil fear drives us so hard that we become blinded and lost in the entanglement of a maze of conflicting desires. The principle of organized effort is lost sight of, and instead of laying hold of nature's forces that are in evidence all around us and permitting those forces to carry us to the heights of great achievement, we defy them, and they become forces of destruction.
Luther Burbank wrote to me, "Your work and mine are interestingly akin. I am helping the laws of nature create more perfect specimens of vegetation, while you are using those same laws, through the law of success philosophy, to create more perfect specimens of thinkers."
The power of self-confidence. Perhaps none of these great forces of nature are more available for our personal growth and self-improvement than is the principle of autosuggestion. But ignorance of this force is leading the majority of the human race to apply it so that it acts as a hindrance and not as a help. Following are four examples, arbitrarily two men and two women, that show just how this misapplication of a great force of nature takes place. Here is a man who meets with some disappointment. A friend proves false, or a neighbor seems indifferent. Forthwith, he decides, through self-suggestion, all people are untrustworthy and all neighbors unappreciative. These thoughts so deeply embed themselves in his subconscious mind that they color his whole attitude toward others. Go back now to what was said in Lesson 2 about the way the dominating thoughts of our minds attract others whose thoughts are similar. Apply the law of attraction and you will soon see and understand why the unbeliever attracts other unbelievers. Reverse the principle. Here is a woman who sees nothing but the best there is in all whom she meets. If her neighbors seem indifferent, she takes no notice of that fact, for she makes it her business to fill her mind with dominating thoughts of optimism and good cheer and faith in others. If people speak to her harshly, she speaks back in tones of softness. Through the operation of this same eternal law of attraction, she draws to herself the attention of people whose attitude toward life and whose dominating thoughts harmonize with her own. Tracing the principle a step further, here is a man who has been well-schooled and has the ability to render the world some needed service. Somewhere, sometime, he has heard it said that modesty is a great virtue, and that to push himself to the front of the stage in the game of life shows egotism. He quietly slips in at the back door and takes a seat at the rear, while other players in the game of life boldly step to the front. He remains in the back row because he fears what they will say. Public opinion, or that which he believes to be public opinion, has him pushed to the rear, and the world hears but little of him. His schooling counts for naught because he is afraid to let the world know that he has had it. He is constantly suggesting to himself, thus using the great force of autosuggestion to his own detriment, that he should remain in the background lest he be criticized, as if criticism would do him any damage or defeat his purpose. Here is a woman who was born of poor parents. Since the first day that she can remember, she has seen evidence of poverty. She has heard talk of poverty. She has felt the icy hand of poverty on her shoulders, and it has so impressed her that she fixes it in her mind as a curse to which she must submit. Quite unconsciously, she permits herself to fall victim to the belief, once poor, always poor, until that belief becomes the dominating thought of her mind. She resembles a horse that has been harnessed and broken until it forgets that it has the potential power with which to throw off that harness. Autosuggestion is rapidly relegating her to the back of the stage of life. Finally, she becomes a quitter. Ambition is gone, Opportunity comes her way no longer, or if it does, she has not the vision to see it. She has accepted her fate. It is a well-established fact that the faculties of the mind, like the limbs of the body, atrophy and wither away if not used. Self-confidence is no exception. It develops when used, but disappears if not used. One of the chief disadvantages of inherited wealth is the fact that it too often leads to inaction and loss of self-confidence. Some years ago, a baby boy was born to Mrs. E.B. McLean in the city of Washington. His inheritance was said to be around $100 million. When this baby was taken for an airing in his carriage, it was surrounded by nurses and assistant nurses and detectives and other servants whose duty it was to see that no harm befell it. As the years passed by, this same vigilance was kept up. This child did not have to dress himself. He had servants who did that. Servants watched over him while he slept and while he was at play. He was not permitted to do anything that a servant could do for him. He had grown to the age of 10 years. One day he was playing in the yard and noticed that the back gate had been left open. In all of his life, he had never been outside of that gate alone, and naturally, that was just the thing that he wished to do. During a moment when the servants were not looking, he dashed out at the gate and was run down and killed by an automobile before he reached the middle of the street. He had used his servants' eyes until his own no longer served him as they might have done had he learned to rely upon them. 20 years ago, a man whom I served as secretary sent his 2 sons away to school. One of them went to the University of Virginia and the other to a college in New York. Each month it was a part of my task to make out a check for $100 for each of these boys. This was their pin money, to be spent as they wished. How profitably I remember the way I envied those boys as I made out those checks each month. I often wondered why the hand of fate bore me into the world in poverty. I could look ahead and see how these boys would rise to the high stations in life while I remained a humble clerk. In due time, the boys returned home with their sheepskins. Their father was a wealthy man who owned banks and railroads and coal mines and other property of great value. Good positions were waiting for the boys in their father's employ. But 20 years of time can play cruel tricks on those who have never had to struggle. Perhaps a better way to state this truth would be that time gives those who have never had to struggle a chance to play cruel tricks on themselves. At any rate, these 2 boys brought home from school other things besides their sheepskins. They came back with well-developed capacities for strong drink, capacities which they developed because the $100 which each of them received each month made it unnecessary for them to struggle. Theirs is a long and sad story, the details of which will not interest you, but you will be interested in their fini. As this lesson is being written, I have on my desk a copy of the newspaper published in the town where these boys lived. Their father has been bankrupted, and his costly mansion where the boys were born has been placed on the block for sale. One of the boys died of alcohol-related causes, and the other one has been confined to a mental health facility. Not all rich men's sons turn out so unfortunately, but the fact remains nevertheless that inaction leads to atrophy, and this in turn leads to loss of ambition and self-confidence. And without these essential qualities, a man will be carried through life on the wings of uncertainty, just as a dry leaf may be carried here and there on the bosom of the stray winds. Far from being a disadvantage, struggle is a decided advantage because it develops those qualities that would forever lie dormant without it. Many a man has found his place in the world because of having been forced to struggle for existence early in life. Lack of knowledge of the advantages accruing from struggle has prompted many a parent to say, "I had to work hard when I was young, but I shall see to it that my children have an easy time." Poor, foolish creatures. An easy time usually turns out to be a greater handicap than the average young man or woman can survive. There are worse things in this world than being forced to work in early life. Forced idleness is far worse than forced labor. Being forced to work and forced to do your best will breed in you temperance and self-control and strength of will and content and 100 other virtues which the idle will never know. Not only does lack of the necessity for struggle lead to weakness of ambition and willpower, but what is more dangerous still, It sets up in a person's mind a state of lethargy that leads to the loss of self-confidence. The person who has quit struggling because effort is no longer necessary is literally applying the principle of autosuggestion, undermining his or her own power of self-confidence. Such a person will finally drift into a frame of mind in which he or she will actually look with contempt upon the person who is forced to carry on. The human mind, if you will pardon repetition, may be likened to an electric battery. It may be positive or it may be negative. Self-confidence is the quality with which the mind is recharged and made positive. Let us apply this line of reasoning to salesmanship and see what part self-confidence plays in this great field of endeavor. One of the greatest salesmen this country has ever seen was once a clerk in a newspaper office. It will be worth your while to analyze the method through which he gained his title as the world's leading salesman. He was a timid young man with a more or less retiring sort of nature. He was one of those who believe it best to slip in by the back door and take a seat at the rear of the stage of life. One evening, he heard a lecture on the subject of this lesson, self-confidence, and that lecture so impressed him that he left the lecture hall with a firm determination to pull himself out of the rut into which he had drifted. He went to the business manager of the paper and asked for a position as an advertising salesman and was put to work on a commission basis. Everyone in the office expected to see him fail, as this sort of salesmanship calls for the most positive type of sales ability. He went to his room and made out a list of a certain type of merchants on whom he intended to call. One would think that he would naturally have made up his list of the names of those whom he believed he could sell with the least effort, but he did nothing of the sort. He placed on his list only the names of the merchants on whom other advertising solicitors had called without making a sale. His list consisted of only 12 names. Before he made a single call, he went out to the city park, took out his list of 12 names, read it over 100 times, saying to himself as he did so, "You will purchase advertising space from me before the end of the month." Then he began to make his calls. The first day he closed sales with 3 of the 12 impossibilities. During the remainder of the week, he made sales to 2 others. By the end of the month, he had opened advertising accounts with all but 1 of the merchants that he had on the list. For the ensuing month, he made no sales, for the reason that he made no calls except on this one obstinate merchant. Every morning, when the store opened, he was on hand to interview this merchant, and every morning the merchant said no. The merchant knew he was not going to buy advertising space, but this young man didn't know it. When the merchant said no, the young man did not hear it, but kept right on coming. On the last day of the month, after having told this persistent young man no for 30 consecutive times, the merchant said, "Look here, young man, you have wasted a whole month trying to sell me. Now, what I would like to know is this. Why have you wasted your time?" "Wasted my time? Nothing," he retorted. "I have been going to school, and you have been my teacher. Now I know all the arguments that a merchant can bring up for not buying, and besides that, I have been drilling myself in self-confidence." Then the merchant said, "I will make a little confession of my own. I, too, have been going to school, and you have been my teacher. You have taught me a lesson in persistence that is worth money to me, and to show you my appreciation, I am going to pay my tuition fee by giving you an order for advertising space." And that was the way in which the Philadelphia North American's best advertising account was brought in. Likewise, it marked the beginning of a reputation that has made that same young man a millionaire. He succeeded because he deliberately charged his own mind with sufficient self-confidence to make that mind an irresistible force. When he sat down to make up that list of 12 names, he did something that 99 people out of 100 would not have done. He selected the names of those whom he believed it would be hard to sell because he understood that out of the resistance he would meet with in trying to sell them would come strength and self-confidence. He was one of the very few who understand that all rivers and some people are crooked because of following the line of least resistance.
No man can become a great leader of men unless he has the milk of human kindness in his own heart and leads by suggestion and kindness rather than by force.
I am going to digress and break the line of thought for a moment to offer a word of advice to spouses and companions. From having analyzed more than 16,000 people, the majority of whom were married, I have learned something that may be of value. You have it within your power to send your mate away to his or her work, business, or profession each day with a feeling of self-confidence that will carry him or her successfully over the rough spots of the day and bring him or her home again at night, smiling and happy. One of my acquaintances of former years married a woman who had a set of false teeth. One day his wife dropped her teeth and broke the plate. The husband picked up the pieces and began examining them. He showed such interest in them that his wife said, "You could make a set of teeth like those if you made up your mind to do it." This man was a farmer whose ambitions had never carried him beyond the bounds of his little farm until his wife made that remark. She walked over and laid her hand on his shoulder and encouraged him to try his hand at dentistry. She finally coaxed him to make the start, and today he is one of the most prominent and successful dentists in the state of Virginia. I know him well, for he is my father. No one can foretell the possibilities of achievement available to the man or woman whose partner supports and encourages bigger and better endeavor. It is your right and your duty to encourage your mate in worthy undertakings until he or she finds an appropriate place in the world. You can induce your mate to put forth greater effort than can any other person in the world. Make your companion believe that nothing within reason is beyond reach, and you will have rendered a service that will go a long way toward winning the battle of life. One of the most successful men in his line in America gives entire credit for his success to his wife. When they were first married, she wrote a creed which he signed and placed over his desk. This is a copy of the creed. Quote, "I believe in myself. I believe in those who work with me. I believe in my employer. I believe in my friends. I believe in my family. I believe that God will lend me everything I need with which to succeed if I do my best to earn it through faithful and honest service. I believe in prayer, and I will never close my eyes and sleep without praying for divine guidance to the end that I will be patient with other people and tolerant with those who do not believe as I do. I believe that success is the result of intelligent effort and does not depend upon luck or sharp practices or double-crossing friends, fellow men, or my employer. I believe I will get out of life exactly what I put into it. Therefore, I will be careful to conduct myself toward others as I would want them to act toward me. I will not slander those whom I do not like. I will not slight my work, no matter what I may see others doing. I will render the best service of which I am capable because I have pledged myself to succeed in life, and I know that success is always the result of conscientious and efficient effort. Finally, I will forgive those who offend me because I realize that I shall sometimes offend others and I will need their forgiveness." Unquote. The woman who wrote this creed was a practical psychologist of the first order. With the influence and guidance of such a marriage partner as a helpmate, any man or woman could achieve noteworthy success. Analyze this creed and you will notice how freely the personal pronoun is used. It starts off with the affirmation of self-confidence, which is perfectly proper. You cannot make this creed your own without developing the positive attitude that would attract people who would aid you in the struggle for success. This would be a splendid creed for every salesperson to adopt. It might not hurt your chances for success if you adopted it. Mere adoption, however, is not enough. You must practice it. Listen to it over and over until you know it by heart. Then repeat it at least once a day until you have literally transformed it into your mental makeup. Keep a copy of it before you as a daily reminder of your pledge to practice it. By doing so, you will be making efficient use of the principle of autosuggestion as a means of developing self-confidence. Never mind what anyone may say about your procedure. Just remember that it is your business to succeed, and this creed, if mastered and applied, will go a long way toward helping you.
If you want a thing done well, call on some busy person to do it. Busy people are generally the most painstaking and thorough in all they do.
You learned in Lesson 2 that any idea you firmly fix in your subconscious mind by repeated affirmation automatically becomes a plan or blueprint which an unseen power uses in directing your efforts toward the attainment of the objective named in the plan. You have also learned that the principle through which you may fix any idea you choose in your mind is called autosuggestion, which simply means a suggestion that you give to your own mind. It was this principle of autosuggestion that Emerson had in mind when he wrote, "Nothing can bring you peace but yourself." You might well remember that nothing can bring you success but yourself. Of course, you will need the cooperation of others if you aim to attain success of a far-reaching nature, but you will never get that cooperation unless you vitalize your mind with the positive attitude of self-confidence. Perhaps you have wondered why a few advance to highly paid positions while others all around them who have as much training and who seemingly perform as much work do not get ahead. Select any two people of these two types that you choose and study them, and the reason why one advances and the other stands still will be quite obvious to you. You will find that the one who advances believes in himself or herself. You will find that belief backed with such dynamic, aggressive action that others know about self-confidence. You will also notice that this self-confidence is contagious. It is impelling, it is persuasive, it attracts others. You will also find that the one who does not advance shows clearly by the look on his face, by the posture of his body, by the lack of briskness in his step, by the uncertainty with which he speaks, that he lacks self-confidence. No one is going to pay much attention to the person who has no confidence in himself. He does not attract others because his mind is a negative force that repels rather than attracts. In no other field of endeavor does self-confidence or the lack of it play such an important part as in the field of sales, and one does not need to be a character analyst to determine on first meeting whether a salesperson possesses this quality of self-confidence. If you have it, the signs of its influence are written all over you. You inspire customers with confidence in you and in the goods you are selling the moment you speak. We come now to the point at which you are ready to take hold of the principle of autosuggestion and make direct use of it in developing yourself into a positive and dynamic and self-reliant person. You are instructed to write out the following formula, sign it, and commit it to memory. Self-confidence formula. I know that I have the ability to achieve the object of my definite purpose. Therefore, I demand of myself persistent, aggressive, and continuous action toward its attainment. I realize that the dominating thoughts of my mind eventually reproduce themselves in outward bodily action and gradually transform themselves into physical reality. Therefore, I will concentrate my mind for 30 minutes daily upon the task of thinking of the person I intend to be, by creating a mental picture of this person and then transforming that picture into reality through practical service. I know that through the principle of autosuggestion, any desire that I persistently hold in my mind will eventually seek expression through some practical means of realizing it. Therefore, I shall devote 10 minutes daily to demanding of myself the development of the factors named in the 17 lessons of this course on the Law of Success. I have clearly mapped out and written down a description of my definite purpose in life for the coming 5 years. I have set a price on my services for each of these 5 years, a price that I intend to earn and receive through strict application of the principle of efficient, satisfactory service which I will render in advance. I fully realize that no wealth or position can long endure unless built upon truth and justice. Therefore, I will engage in no transaction that does not benefit all whom it affects. I will succeed by attracting to me the forces I wish to use and the cooperation of other people. I will induce others to serve me because I will first serve them. I will eliminate hatred, envy, jealousy, selfishness, and cynicism by developing love for all humanity, because I know that a negative attitude toward others can never bring me success. I will cause others to believe in me because I will believe in them and in myself. I will sign my name to this formula, commit it to memory, and repeat it aloud once a day with full faith that it will gradually influence my entire life so that I will become a successful and happy worker in my chosen field of endeavor. Before you sign your name to this formula, make sure that you intend to carry out its instructions. Back of this formula lies a law that is difficult to explain. Psychologists refer to this law as autosuggestion, and let it go at that. But you should bear in mind one point about which there is no uncertainty, and that is the fact that whatever this law is, it actually works. Another point to be kept in mind is the fact that just as electricity will turn the wheels of industry and serve mankind in a million other ways, or snuff out life if wrongly applied, So will this principle of autosuggestion lead you up the mountainside of peace and prosperity, or down into the valley of misery and poverty, according to the application you make of it. If you fill your mind with doubt and unbelief in your ability to achieve, then the principle of autosuggestion takes this spirit of unbelief and sets it up in your subconscious mind as your dominating thought, and slowly but surely draws you into the whirlpool of failure. But if you fill your mind with radiant self-confidence, the principle of autosuggestion takes this belief and sets it up as your dominating thought and helps you master the obstacles that fall in your way until you reach the mountaintop of success.